You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. We're talking about litigation involving UW Oshkosh's foundation. Two former administrators of the university pleaded guilty this week to felony misconduct. It's in connection with that financial scandal involving five building projects on campus. Are you a student at UW Oshkosh, or perhaps a parent of a student there? What do you think of this case? Do you think it was okay for UW Oshkosh to say it would use UW system money to fund private foundation projects? We're at 800-642-1234. Davey Shastri is the statewide higher education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Davey, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
So in the spring of 2018, these two former UW Oshkosh executives, they were charged with using taxpayer money to fund the university's private foundation. And this week, we saw their plea deal that was reached in the case. What was the plea deal?
It's kind of a little bit different than that. They were charged with signing letters that would back the foundation's loans that they took out for these five building projects. And so then the question was, is it legal for someone who works for the university to sign a letter essentially backing a loan that a private institution, this foundation, is taking out? And the outcome ends up being that they ended up pleading guilty to one of the five counts that they were facing of felony misconduct in office, which centers specifically around one of the five letters that they signed. And that one was for a downtown. It was money to renovate a downtown hotel in Oshkosh.
And so this is the chancellor, the former chancellor and the former vice chancellor involved in these building projects. Is that right?
Right. So the former chancellor and vice chancellor signed these letters that essentially told banks that if the UW Oshkosh Foundation, which is taking out these loans to build these buildings or buy these buildings, can't end up paying their loans, if they run out of money, they were essentially saying UW Oshkosh would come in and make sure that those bills get paid.
And these were five building projects. What types of buildings were these?
Yeah, so there was the one that was the downtown hotel. That was the Best Western Premier Waterfront Hotel, which got renovated and is still in use today. There was also a welcome center that was on campus. So the hotel was off campus, but this welcome center is something that UW Oshkosh is still using today. And actually, UW System now owns it. There were two biodigesters, which are buildings that take plant waste and animal waste and turn them into energy. One of those is now sold, and then the other one is still owned by the university and is used for research, and the university is generating revenue from it. And then the last one was the Oshkosh, UW Oshkosh Sports Complex.
And how much money, how many millions of dollars altogether were funneling into these projects?
So it was like the loans were for tens of millions, and then there's also a question of money going from the university to the foundation, which the state says is against state law. So there were $11 million that at some point or another went from the university to the foundation for these five building projects. And so that was another kind of piece of this where there wasn't a whole lot of clear accounting related to these sorts of transactions, and that money shouldn't have been flowing in that direction.
We're talking with Davey Shastri. She's a statewide higher education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And we're talking about two former UW Oshkosh administrators who were fined this week in a building misconduct scheme and using public funds for foundation building projects. Davey, UW Oshkosh has said that since the building projects were for university usage, it was okay to use the public UW system funds. Can you help us understand both sides of this argument?
Yeah, so the defense lawyers actually were kind of making that argument. And actually, right after these allegations came to light, The UW Oshkosh Foundation ended up declaring bankruptcy because they couldn't and they couldn't pay their bills. And so that's one of seven cases that has been created on the state or federal level in courts, trying to unravel and figure out what happened in this situation. And so when they filed for bankruptcy, there was a federal judge who did rule that because the buildings were for UW Oshkosh's use and UW Oshkosh's use alone, in some way, she could see the argument that UW system, UW Oshkosh, was responsible for the debt taken out. So that was another part of this.
Well, this case has brought questions really around the boundary between taxpayer money and private money at public universities and the interplay of accounting structures. What types of boundaries are in place?
Yeah, so there was an audit that was done, one of five audits around this by the Legislative Audit Bureau, and they looked into this. They looked into what safeguards are in place, what requirements are in place for foundations and the like boundaries between what the relationship should be between these public and private entities. And one of the things that they found was there were other instances of money going back and forth, but there were, and then there were also a lot of instances of poor record keeping that made it seem like this could be something that comes up later, and that's definitely a concern that legislators have. Representative Dave Murphy, who's the chair of the Colleges and Universities Committee in the Assembly, he, you know, is proposing a bill that's going through right now trying to unravel and like put clearer standards on how this relationship should look on the state level.
Mm-hmm.
But it is really complicated because there are so many different entities that could be, you know, private and affiliated with a university, whether it's the UW-Milwaukee Youth Choir, or it's the Paper Science Foundation at UW Students Point, or it's a foundation like the UW Oshkosh Foundation, which exists solely to get money so that they can support the university for a lot of different things.
Right. I mean, you know, foundations are exceedingly important to universities, colleges, technical colleges, community colleges. And so what are the implications here as, you know, education goes forward and you figure out how these funding streams work together or don't work together?
Right, right. More and more universities are relying on their private foundations to do things that they wouldn't be able to do, or that would take a lot more time if they were to do as a public entity. And so this is, you know, an issue and a relationship that exists on campuses across the country. And so the implications are that there does need to be this clarity around what is and isn't okay. And I guess the counter argument that you know, system leaders have made is that they have instituted multiple changes in accounting and in standards and setting clearer standards since the UW Oshkosh audit came out. The Audit Bureau made 12 recommendations, and the last time I checked a few months ago, they had finished, they'd completed nine of them, nine of the changes that were recommended. And so changes have been made, but there's still a lot of questions surrounding this as it kind of continues through the court.
Davey, thank you for joining us.
Yep, thank you.
Davey Shastri is a statewide higher education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Coming up, we learn about a piece of Wisconsin history, ice harvesting. Back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, it's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we'll be looking at the condition of dams across Wisconsin. There are roughly 4,700 of them in our state. At least 350 are labeled as a high hazard or significant hazard. Do you live near one? Has there ever been a dam burst, or have you seen water overtop it? What do you wonder about the condition of the dams in your county? Join in right now, 800-642-1234, as we prepare to talk with the DNR's dam safety engineer. But first, temperatures have plummeted across our state, and that means that most of our lakes are frozen. So if we traveled back in time to the late 1800s, this would be prime time for a big Wisconsin industry that's fallen by the wayside. That's ice harvesting. WPR host Keely Baltina talked with Madison historian Ann Weidlich about why the state was a leader in ice harvesting and how it gave up a leg up in industries like beer brewing and meatpacking.
As we're getting started with this ice harvesting conversation, I can't help but think of the movie Frozen. It opens with these images of people with big saws,
yes,
you know, sawing through these huge chunks of ice and throwing them on sleds. Is that ice harvesting?
Yes, it is. It's a quite realistic portrayal of ice harvesting. The saw is different from an ordinary wood saw. It has a handle that comes up at an angle. And so if you see a funny saw in an antique store that's not like an ordinary wood saw, it probably is an ice saw.
So we see these mostly men outside doing really difficult work in the cold, getting these big blocks of ice. Why was ice harvesting so important?
Well, people wanted ice. They had ice boxes starting in the mid-1800s. And they needed ice to keep food cold in these ice boxes. But also, the growth of the ice industry was because of meat packing and also beer brewing. People in Wisconsin and in the United States liked a lighter beer called lager beer. And in order to brew and store lager beer, it needed to be at a cold temperature. So they would use ice to keep the beer cold, both brewing and during storage. But then also the meatpacking industry, because it used to be that you either had to smoke the meat or salt the meat or turn it into sausages in order to keep it, particularly through the summertime. And when they discovered that you could cool down the meat, and if you kept it cold, it would last longer, then they went out and harvested all the ice they could find. And eventually the big meat packers got into making ice in mechanically rather than cutting it out of the ice ponds.
The industries you're pointing to are big Wisconsin industries from
yes.
beer making. We even think of, you know, Oscar Mayer's presence
yes.
here.
Yes, and Oscar Mayer started out cutting ice out of Lake Mendota, but early on realized that it was not going to be enough and it was an awful lot of hard work. And so they made very fine, very clear, very pure ice, and then they allowed their workers to take some of that ice home. And then the workers told their neighbors, and their neighbors wanted some of that ice too. So actually, Oscar Mayer also got into the ice delivery business up until after World War II. And then almost everyone had a mechanical refrigerator and could make their own ice and didn't need ice delivery. But yeah, Oscar Mayer was into ice as much as meat.
And that industry developed secondary to the ice harvesting, right? The ice was necessary for those to thrive here.
Yes. Yes. And as I say, people wanted ice for ice boxes came in the mid-1800s. And their quality varied about depending on how much money you wanted to spend on an ice box. But they weren't really that cold, and it wasn't really that satisfactory. And so people switched over to mechanical refrigerators as soon as they became available in the late 1920s.
What was the role of the railroad here in Wisconsin to take Wisconsin ice all over the place?
Yes, we were very fortunate in Wisconsin. We not only had nice cold winters that produced nice hard ice, but we also had a lot of railroads coming into the state at first because of the lumbering in the northern part of the state. But then it was obvious that ice could be shipped in boxcars to the southern states. They would really like some of our nice, hard, cold ice. And so with the North Chicago, Milwaukee, St. Paul and Pacific Railroad and the Illinois Central Railroad, both of them shipped Illinois Central more down towards St. Louis, and the Northwestern Railroad down to Chicago.
How did they keep it cold once it got to warmer climates, or how did they ship ice in the summertime?
Well, they had developed refrigerated boxcars that would store the ice fairly well. And then there were also big ice houses down in Chicago and St. Louis and elsewhere where, again, they would store the ice. And they were insulated, of course, with either straw or sawdust often. They did lose ice. I mean, it did melt. They couldn't keep it totally hard. But these ice houses were constructed in such a way that the water from the ice melting was taken away and the air was circulated to try and preserve as much of the ice as possible.
Ann Weidlich is a former reference librarian at the Madison Public Library, who's now a local historian here in Madison. And we are talking about ice harvesting, which was a really prominent industry here in Wisconsin, 100, 150 years ago. And let's go back to that ice harvesting. What did that work look like? Can you paint a picture for us?
Well, first of all, they had to scrape the ice clear of any snow that had accumulated on the ice. And then they would go out with what was called ice plows. And these were rows of teeth on what looked like a saw drawn by horses that would cut a groove into the ice in about 20-inch sections. And then they would go the other way to cut another 20-inch section going the other way. Then they would use these ice saws that we talked about to actually literally saw through these grooves. And then they would use ice picks to push these blocks of ice into channels that led up to the ice house at the edge of the lake. And there would be a conveyor belt that would drag these ice blocks up into the ice house. And there would be men up there who would push the ice blocks around in the ice house to get them stacked upright, and then also adding the straw or sawdust to prevent the ice blocks from freezing together, but also to insulate the whole section in general. And so it was a lot of very hard, very cold, often wet. People used to come to watch the men do the ice harvesting because very often a horse or a man would fall in the water. And that was a lot of excitement to drag the horse or the person out of the water. Was a thrill that you could go to the edge and watch and see if that would happen.
Who were the people who did the work?
Well, in Wisconsin, we had a lot of farms in the summertime, and they would hire single men mostly to do farm work in the summer. And then these men were, quote, free, so to speak, in the wintertime to take up this kind of employment. It would last for 2, 3, 4 weeks, probably at the end of January, sometime in February. They might get as much as $1, $1.50 a day to do this work.
Where in Wisconsin were the best places to harvest ice?
It would have been lakes, and especially a deeper lake, so that the water was still and didn't get a lot of bubbles into it, which would happen if the water was flowing. We had a lot of mill ponds throughout the state because the mill was used in the summer or winter mostly the summer for grinding wheat and flour and sawing lumber. So these mill ponds were pretty good. And so almost every little town in Wisconsin had some effort to cut ice out of the mill ponds and store it for their own local use and maybe a little bit of delivery to the nearby farms. But it was Milwaukee and Madison that had the biggest ice harvesting companies and would do the most in terms of delivering it elsewhere.
Now we have refrigerators and freezers that run off of electricity. Does ice harvesting still happen today?
Yes, a little bit. Several historical societies throughout the state will do ice harvesting demonstrations with the equipment that they've collected in their museums. And then I understand that the Amish are still active in cutting ice because they don't rely on electricity.
Ann, thank you so much for talking to us about this.
You're very welcome.
And that was WPR host Keely Baltina talking with Madison historian Ann Weidlich about Wisconsin's ice harvesting legacy. You can explore more of this history. You can see old pictures of ice harvesters. It's all at wiscontext.org. Coming up, we talk with the DNR's dam safety engineer who manages dam emergencies and inspections statewide. She gets us up to speed on the condition of our dams. And we go to Monroe County, where they've dealt with several dam breaches, and now they have a new climate change plan they're working off of. Have you incurred flooding in recent years? Is that related to an infrastructure failure? How has the increased intensity of storms impacted your land and home? And dam operators and engineers, let's hear from you. Phone lines are open right now, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We talk about the state of dams and hear from you after this news update on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin is home to roughly 4,700 dams. And since 2008, there have been 14 dams that have failed, with a spike in 2018 due to severe storms and flooding. Do you live near a dam? Do you know what condition it's in? Has your community been working with engineers to maintain dams in your area? Perhaps you're a dam owner. What should we know about them? You have a line, 800-642-1234. Tanya Lorigan is a dam safety engineer for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and she helps oversee responsibilities of the dam safety program, which includes dam inspections, emergency response assistance, and regulatory matters related to the design, construction, and safety of dams here in Wisconsin. Tanya, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. So, what does your work look like as a safety engineer really focused on dams?
We have a variety of requirements that we oversee with the Department Dam Safety Program. We are responsible for inspections of the dams and ensuring that owners are inspecting their dams. When dams are in need of repair, we review those plans and specifications that are submitted to us. And we're also involved with dam transfer of dam ownership, as well as removal of dams. We provide technical assistance to owners if there's some type of emergency response or incident at a dam. So we have a lot of regulatory authority related to those aspects of the dams. And the idea behind that is really that our main goal is to protect life, health, and property. So a lot of those requirements are in place to support protecting life, health, and property for residents in Wisconsin.
Well, give us sort of a lay of the land here for our dams. There are around 4,700 in the state, but just 920 are large dams that are managed by the DNR. How do the rest get managed?
Well, actually, of those 4,700 dams, a large percentage of those, not just the 920, are regulated by the DNR. We have them broken into two types of categories. There's small dams and large dams, and 920 are large dams, and that category is based on the height of the dam and the amount of water, the volume of the water that it impounds. So the large dams, given that they likely have a higher risk downstream, there's additional design requirements, inspection requirements that are involved with those dams.
So those dams would get more attention than a smaller dam.
Exactly. But they're all regulated. But those larger dams have more requirements. There's three different types of categories with those large dams. There's high, significant, and low. There's about 200 high hazard dams in Wisconsin, 150 significant, and the remaining of those are low. And what a high hazard dam, that doesn't mean that it's high hazard, that it's imminent failures is likely. What it means is that should the dam fail, there's a possibility of or probability of loss of life downstream. Significant hazard dams, again, it's looking at the risk downstream, that there's a possibility of property damage, and low hazard dams, it would be that loss of life or property damage is relatively unlikely.
Some of these dams also produce hydroelectricity. How is the oversight
site there?
So hydroelectric power, there's about probably over 120 large dams that produce hydroelectricity. And those are actually regulated by the federal government, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. So in those situations, the state does not have regulatory authority over those. We may be involved in terms of involvement in terms of environmental resource impacts, but the inspection, maintenance, repairs, that's done by FERC.
FERC meaning the
Federal Energy Regulatory Commission.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And there are some dams that are not even on water. What would be those examples?
So there's some, if they're not on a water course, the state does not have regulatory authority over those. Those could be liquid substances other than water. So, for example, a manure pit that's not on a water course. Those associated with cranberry operations, those are other ones that the state does not regulate.
And then 3 in every 5 dams in our state are owned by a company or an individual. How does dam ownership impact their management and upkeep?
Well, private owners are responsible for, they have the same types of requirements as a municipality. Really, they have those same responsibilities. It's just that there's a large percentage of them. Oftentimes, they're the smaller dams, and those kinds of uses could be for watering cattle, wildlife habitat, aesthetics. So they just tend to be the smaller ones kind of in the rural areas as opposed to the larger dams where you have a lot of recreation uses right in the heart of a community.
And are those private dam owners, are they expected to submit reports, submit inspection reports,
yep. mm-hmm.
things
same,
like that?
Same requirements.
Same protocols.
Yep, same requirements. Yep. It's you can have a private owner that has a small dam. You can have a private owner that has a large dam.
When you talk about a dam that's in a high hazard category, because there could be loss of life mm-hmm. if that dam would burst or overtop, something like that, are you seeing those situations here in Wisconsin where we should be taking extra precautions because dams are aging?
Dams are aging, and we do have a lot of precautions that are already in place with the regulations, and we ensure, again, to protect life, health, and property, that they're being managed and operated in compliance with those requirements. So, for example, all of the large dams, regardless of whether it's large, significant, or high, they need to do what's called a dam failure analysis. And what that analysis is that it actually looks at what happens when the dam fails. Where's the water going to go? How high is it going to get? And how long does it take to get to those locations downstream? So all those large dams are required to have that. And in Wisconsin, we actually require that dam failure floodplain map gets adopted into the local community's floodplain zoning ordinances to prevent future development in those areas. So we do have those precautions in place. Mm-hmm. And so one thing that we can do with a lot of these increased rainfall precipitation events is really ensure that those things are getting completed and implemented.
We're talking about the condition of dams around the state with the DNR's dam safety engineer, Tanya Lorigan. You can join in 800-642-1234. Has a dam ever breached in your community? When did it happen? Did that impact your home? How did it affect your community? Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Now let's bring in Bob McKeel. He directs the Monroe County Land Conservation Department. And during an August 2018 rainstorm, 3 dams breached in his county and 3 more were damaged. He joins us from our studios in La Crosse this morning. Bob, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Good morning, Tanya.
Bob, take us back to that early morning in August 2018 when you learned of the dam failures in your county. What was that like?
That's a very emotional moment in time. As far as it was actually August 27th that evening, we were receiving a lot of rain in Monroe County and specifically where I live. I could tell that the storms were lining up south and it was a constant rumble to the south. And didn't sleep a lot of that night because you have the responsibility of these large dams in your county as far as the operation and maintenance, and you're concerned about people's welfare and safety. Got to work that morning, listened to the radio about Coon Valley experiencing flooding, roads damaged and out, and right away I started thinking about the Coon Creek dams, and Monroe County has seven in that watershed. And when I got to work, I noticed my phone had a message on it, and took that message, and one of the landowners, farmers that operates around one of the structures, just plainly left a message, dam is gone.
Oh.
And so I called him back immediately, and I could tell in his voice, nervous, very worried about what happened in that situation. And he basically, all he knew was gone. There's no water behind the dam, lots of damage. You need to check it out. And so I grabbed the NRCS civil tech engineer, and we headed out there immediately.
What did you see when you got there?
So getting there was a challenge since I was in Portland Township and there was a lot of infrastructure damage on roads. We were finally able to navigate to that spot. We got to the town road where it enters into the private property, and we parked right there because everything was destroyed. And you walk down into the valley floor, and keep in mind the trout stream is on the opposite side of the valley floor. Immediately I see trout flopping in the mud on the opposite side. And I looked up the valley, and the farmer has a pumpkin patch. It's called Tucker's Pumpkin Patch. And everything he had there was erased. And I knew things were not looking good as we navigate up the valley floor, crossing the stream where we could in a couple places. It was probably 5-6 times wider than it normally should be. And as far as destruction, trees gone. And we finally get up towards the structure itself, and you could see boulders the size of vehicles laying everywhere below the dam. And you notice that the hillside that the dam abutted to was gone. And
it had reshaped the actual earth around it. How long had that dam been there?
Most of the dams are about 52 to 55 years they've been in existence. They were built in the late 50s, early 60s. So we actually got to the site, walked up the embankment, and the unique part is all the grass on the dam was laid down. And so right away you're thinking, what the heck happened here? And then when we got to the top of the structure, which is 35 to 40 feet higher than the valley floor, which is an earthen berm, and you start looking around, and you could tell that the auxiliary spillway ran, and then the grass was knocked down where you're standing, so you knew that the dam's overtopped.
Talking with Bob McKeel, director of the Monroe County Land Conservation Department, and Tanya Lorigan is here. She is the DNR's dam safety engineer. Has your county dealt with breaches? Do you live near a dam? Join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Back in a moment. More conversation here on the Ideas Network. On a Friday, we're taking a close look at a really important piece of infrastructure in our state, and that is dams. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. There are homes, there are businesses, farmland, entire communities that rely on dams to do their job. And according to data compiled by the Associated Press, Wisconsin has only 6 dams considered a risk to human safety that are in poor condition. But even so, 8 dams were washed out by record-setting rainfall in 2018. Do you own one? What kind of liability comes with that? How often must it be inspected? What emergency plan do you have in place in case it breaks? Are you a licensed engineer who inspects dams? What are you seeing out there? We're at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us, WPR Mornings. The dams safety, the DNR safety engineer for dams, Tanya Lorigan, is here, and Bob McKeel is here. He directs the Monroe County Land Conservation Department. Tanya, rainstorms and weather events like Bob has described, they've certainly gotten more severe in the past decade. Are our state's dams able to handle these more intense, more frequent storms?
That is something that we are currently looking at. They do, high hazard dams are required to actually have the capacity to handle a 1,000-year flood event. Significant, required to have the capacity to meet a 500-year flood event, and low, 100-year flood event. So that is something that we are continuing to work with owners, that if they don't have adequate spillway capacity, that they get those repaired and upgraded so that they're meeting those requirements. But I do agree, we are seeing those increased rainfalls with more intense storms. And so that is something that we're proactively, you know, we're really looking at that in terms of how can we be more proactive with that. As I was mentioning earlier, I think we do have a lot of requirements that are currently in place to try to have these dams stable and functioning during these types of events.
Bob, how did the state and federal local officials handle the fallout, handle the emergency in the immediate aftermath of the dam failures in your county?
The first and foremost is, you know, make sure everybody is safe and you can get the roads back open, whether it's a town or a county. You know, basically you have to help with all the private citizens and what possible funding to do the repairs and provide assistance. So navigating through the FEMA, NRCS, DNR, county funds, what can we bring to the table to help and repair these structures was first and foremost as we moved forward.
What was the aftermath like? Did you rebuild these dams? What is it like there now?
So the immediate response is, okay, evaluate all the structures. So federal engineers, program managers basically flew in from different areas of the United States to take a look at this situation because it was very unique. And from that field trip report, you know, the recommendations came in. The three that were damaged and still functional, to repair them as soon as possible. And the three that breached was to stabilize the structure and remove debris so it doesn't cause a situation down the road if a flood event comes along. So in 2019, we were able to secure funds from NRCS to repair the three damaged ones and stabilize the three breached ones. And we just recently finished that.
Now, that's a long project. Tanya, when a dam fails, are they replaced? What options does a community have?
When a dam fails, the department issues what's called an administrative order to repair or abandon a dam. And the reason that we do that is so that we have time frames associated with that, so we just don't have these neglected structures on the landscape for years. So the owner then has an option to really investigate, do they want to repair the dam? Do they want to remove it? You know, the dam safety program, we want a safe dam, and that can be done through removing it or repairing it. And so when they do those, they look at doing those repairs and getting those back up to kind of the condition that it needs to be in if they do select repair.
How do you repair a dam?
There's a process in terms of looking at, they hire an engineer, and a registered engineer in Wisconsin, and preparing those plans and specifications in terms of looking where it was damaged. Can you just do a partial repair for that one part that was damaged? Or is there a more major reconstruction that needs to be put in place? With that, you're looking at, like I mentioned earlier, the spillway capacity, making sure that you can pass those flood flows.
Talking with Tanya Lorigan, she is the Wisconsin DNR Dam Safety Engineer. Bob McKeel is here. He's Director of Monroe County Land Conservation. Still time for you. We're talking about the condition of dams in Wisconsin. What questions do you have about them? What do you want to know? We're at 800-642-1234. Brad called in to share that he lives in Cedarburg, where some community members want dams removed to help the trout. Tanya, when can removing a dam be an appropriate choice for a community? What goes into that decision?
There's a lot. In terms of the community, what do the residents in the community value? Do they value having that impoundment there in terms of boating or aesthetics? Do they value having a natural stream to allow fish passage and improve trout habitat? So a lot of it depends on, in terms of public interest, what would they like to see that stream or that impoundment be in their community? There's economics that also plays a really really big factor in that, because dams, they're costly to maintain and to continue to operate. And so it's a matter of the funds. Does that owner have the ability to continue to do those repairs and in that operation? So those are two of the real key things that go into that decision-making process.
Bob, along with the three in your county, Monroe County, two dams also failed in Vernon County, and that county studied this event, came out with a report. What do you know about what led to those failures?
The two in Vernon County, it was the same event that destroyed the three in Monroe County, which were in the West Fork of the Kickapoo. Those were a little different, that the actual auxiliary spillway or emergency spillway down-cutted and eroded out, which led to their failure, versus the Monroe County structures. When the water was overtopping these structures, the principal pipe and the auxiliary spillway was running full, and water was actually concentrated on the opposite abutment, which doomed the structure by eroding the topsoil, reaching the sandstone, and basically melted away and led to the failure.
Monroe County has since developed this task force to look at climate change. What solutions is your county planning to implement? What is it coming up with?
So the first objective was to recognize climate change is happening. And second, we came up with 10 objectives or goals that the county wants to focus on. First and foremost, we identified that we need to do a better job of identifying where these isolated storms are happening, monitor precipitation, and warn the public as far as flooding goes. It just seems that the southern part of the county is really getting hammered, and this is a cumulative effect. This has been going on since 2007. I think we've had 17 to 18 different major storm events in the Driftless area, not necessarily Monroe County, but we need to do a better job of alerting the public. Second is we need to get the public out of the way if these big flood events are going to happen. So we have a floodplain. Nature reclaimed it, and we need to keep people out of there. We're just fortunate enough in 2018 nobody got killed.
Tanya, is the state prepared financially to respond to dam failures and to the damage that we see?
In terms of the dam itself, actually that responsibility in terms of taking care of that dam does fall on the owner. There's funds available after those incidents. Like Bob mentioned, you have Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, funds that may be available with those public incidents that occur. The DNR, we do have two grant programs, a municipal dam grant program, where municipalities that own dams can either apply for funds to repair or remove dams. And there's also a dam removal grant program that private owners can apply for. So there are some funds available for these types of incidents.
Well, Tanya, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Tanya Lorigan is a dam safety engineer for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. And Bob, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your story.
Thanks for having me.
Bob McKeel is the director of the Monroe County Land Conservation Department, and he joined us from our studios in La Crosse. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.